The three polos started by way of Palestine, and not by the Crimea, as in the previous expedition. They had with them a gold tablet and other indications from the Great Khan that must have greatly facilitated their journey. The Great Khan had asked for some oil from the lamp that burns in the Holy Sepulchre at Jerusalem, and so thither they first went, and then by way of Cilicia into Armenia. They went thus far north because the Sultan of Egypt was raiding the Ilkhan domains at this time. Thence they came by way of Mesopotamia to Ormuz on the Persian Gulf, as if they contemplated a sea voyage. At Ormuz they met merchants from India. For some reason they didn't take ship, but instead turned northward through the Persian deserts, and so by way of Balkh, over the Pamir to Kashgar, and by way of Khotan and the Lobnor, so following in the footsteps of Huan Chuang, into the Huang Ho Valley and on to Pekin. Pekin, Polo calls Cambaluc. Northern China, Cathay, that's to say Khitan, and southern China, of the former Sung dynasty, Manzi. At Pekin was the Great Khan, and they were hospitably entertained. Marco particularly pleased Kublai. He was young and clever, and it's clear he had mastered the Tatar language very thoroughly. He was given an official position and sent on several missions, chiefly in southwest China. The tale he had to tell of vast stretches of smiling and prosperous country, all the way excellent hostelries for travellers and fine vineyards, fields and gardens, of many abbeys of Buddhist monks, of manufacturers of cloth, of silk and gold, and many fine taffeters, a constant succession of cities and boroughs and so on, first roused the incredulity and then fired the imagination of all Europe. He told of Burma and of its great armies with hundreds of elephants, and how these animals were defeated by the Mongol bowmen, and also of the Mongol conquest of Pegu. He told of Japan, and greatly exaggerated the amount of gold in that country. And still more wonderful, he told of Christians and Christian rulers in China, and of a certain Prester John, John the Priest, who was the king of a Christian people. These people he hadn't seen. Apparently they were a tribe of Nestorian Tatars in Mongolia. An understandable excitement probably made Rusticiano overemphasized what must have seemed to him the greatest marvel of the whole story, and Prester John became one of the most stimulating legends of the 14th and 15th centuries. It encouraged European enterprise enormously to think that far away in China was a community of their co-religionists, presumably ready to welcome and assist them. For 3 years, Marco ruled the city of Wang Chao as governor, and he probably impressed the Chinese inhabitants as being very little more of a foreigner than any Tatar would have been. He may also have been sent on a mission to India. Chinese records mention a certain polo attached to the Imperial Council in 1277, a very valuable confirmation of the general truth of the polo story. The polos had taken about 3.5 years to get to China. They stayed there upwards of 16. Then they began to feel homesick. They were the protégés of Kublai, and possibly they felt that his favours roused a certain envy that might have disagreeable results after his death. They sought his permission to return. For a time he refused it, and then an opportunity occurred. Argon, the Ilkhan monarch of Persia, the grandson of Hulagu, Kublai's brother, had lost his Mongol wife, and on her deathbed had promised not to wed any other woman but a Mongol of her own tribe. He sent ambassadors to Pekin, and a suitable princess was selected, a girl of 17. To spare her the fatigues of the caravan route, it was decided to send her by sea with a suitable escort. The barons in charge of her asked for the company of the polos, because these latter were experienced travellers and sage men, and the polos snatched at this opportunity of getting homeward. The expedition sailed from some port on the east of South China. They stayed long in Sumatra and South India, and they reached Persia after a voyage of 2 years. They delivered the young lady safely to Argon's successor, for Argon was dead, and she married Argon's son. The Polos then went by Tabriz to Trebizond, sailed to Constantinople, and got back to Venice about 1295. It's related that the returned travellers, dressed in Tatar garb, were refused admission to their own house. It was some time before they could establish their identity. Many people who admitted that were still inclined to look askance at them as shabby wanderers, and in order to dispel such doubts, they gave a great feast, and when it was at its height, they had their old padded suits brought to them, dismissed the servants, and then ripped open these garments, whereupon an incredible display of rubies, sapphires, carbuncles, emeralds, and diamonds poured out before the dazzled company. Even after this, Marco's accounts of the size and population of China were received with much furtive mockery. The wits nicknamed him Il Milione, because he was always talking of millions of people and millions of ducats. Such was the story that raised eyebrows first in Venice and then throughout the Western world. The European literature, and especially the European romance of the 15th century, echoes with the names in Marco Polo's story, with Cathay and Cambaluc and the like. Fourth, these travels of Marco Polo were only the beginning of a very considerable intercourse. That intercourse was to bring many revolutionary ideas and many revolutionary things to Europe, including a greatly extended use of paper and printing from blocks, the almost equally revolutionary use of gunpowder in warfare, and the mariner's compass, which was to release the European shipping from navigation by coasting. The popular imagination has always been disposed to ascribe every such striking result to Marco Polo. He's become the type and symbol for all such interchanges. As a matter of fact, there's no evidence that he had any share in these three importations. There were many mute Marco Polos who never met their Rustigianos, and history hasn't preserved their names. Before we go on, however, to describe the great widening of the mental horizons of Europe that was now beginning, and to which this book of travels was to contribute very materially, it'll be convenient first to note a curious side consequence of the great Mongol conquests, the appearance of the Ottoman Turks upon the Dardanelles, and next to state in general terms the breaking up and development of the several parts of the empire of Genghis Khan. The Ottoman Turks were a little band of fugitives who fled southwesterly before the first invasion of western Turkestan by Genghis. They made their long way from Central Asia over deserts and mountains and through alien populations, seeking some new lands in which they might settle. A small band of alien herdsmen, says Sir Mark Sykes, wandering unchecked through crusades and counter-crusades, principalities, empires, and states. Where they camped, how they moved and preserved their flocks and herds, where they found pasture, how they made their peace with the various chiefs through whose territories they passed, are questions which one may well ask in wonder. They found a resting place at last, and kindred and congenial neighbours, on the tablelands of Asia Minor among the Seljuk Turks. Most of this country, the modern Anatolia, was now largely Turkish in speech and Muslim in religion, except that there was a considerable proportion of Greeks, Jews, and Armenians in the town populations. No doubt the various strains of Hittite, Phrygian, Trojan, Lydian, Ionian Greek, Sumerian, Galatian, and Italian from the Pergamus times still flowed in the blood of the people, but they had long since forgotten these ancestral elements. They were indeed much the same blend of ancient Mediterranean, dark whites, Nordic Aryans, Semites and Mongolians, as were the inhabitants of the Balkan Peninsula. But they believed themselves to be a pure Turanian race, and altogether superior to the Christians on the other side of the Bosphorus. Gradually, the Ottoman Turks became important, and at last dominant among the small principalities into which the Seljuk Empire, the Empire of Rome, had fallen.